Thank you. Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 13703, Wong versus Hawaiian Airlines Incorporated. Arguing for the petitioner, R. Stephen Gischel. Arguing for the respondent, C. Michael Heer. Also appearing for the respondent, Amanda Jones. Argument on merits.
Good afternoon to our counsel today. Are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, and you reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning light with 7 minutes to go, and then a warning with 5 minutes to go, Mr. Heer. Okay, very well. Please proceed, Mr. Gischel.
First off, thank you for having an oral argument. This seems like it's first time in 15 years. I don't know. Anyway, thanks.
Well, welcome here.
Pleasure to be here. And my client, Gene Wong, is seated in the front row over here. But
all right. Thank you.
Now, in preparation for this argument, I've come to the conclusion that there are at least five major topics that I wanted to talk about, and I'm sure I'll be trying to answer all of your questions. The first one is that Gene Wong's negligent tort claim and his UDAP claim is not, none of those are preempted by the Railway Labor Act. And not only that, but they're not preempted by the ERISA, because all you have to do is look at the contract.
Is the ERISA claim before us? I mean, are you addressing something that's not really before us?
No, I'm not.
In other words, the ERISA argument, there was no ruling by the lower court, correct?
I don't agree with that, Judge, because Judge Sakamoto asked me if I was claiming that the duty came from ERISA, and I said, no, it doesn't. But the defense claimed that it was preempted by ERISA.
And but the court's order didn't address ERISA.
Pardon?
The court's order didn't address ERISA.
That's correct. I submitted an order to Judge Sakamoto, and he didn't sign mine, and he signed Hawaiian Air's. So, you know, he said, okay, your motion is granted to defense counsel, Michael Heer. And they said, oh, thank you very much. Not very much, but thank you. It's in the record. So he did grant the motion to dismiss or for summary judgment under ERISA preemption, although it didn't find its way in the order. Okay? So now that takes me back to the contract. Let's look at what the contract says.
Just so you know, we do record our proceedings, so you got to speak into the mic so that we don't, when you're talking. I know you were sort of talking there off mic, so I just let you know. Just no, it's I think a sort of a, for the public's benefit, we do record our arguments. So,
the pertinent part of this contract, the CBA, collective bargaining agreement, has one sentence in it. And first off, this contract is with employees. Now, Gene Wong has been a retired pilot for now over 18 years. He's not in this, he's not covered by this agreement as an employee. The Intermediate Court of Appeals decision saying that on the first page, not the first page, the early parts of that opinion, say that this is an agreement between the pilots and the retired pilots. And that's not correct at all. That is absolutely wrong. This contract is only with the pilots, and he's not one of the pilots. So that's clearly not correct. And that's on page 4, down at the bottom of the opinion. It says, the parties do not dispute that the pilot's agreement constitutes a CBA between Hawaiian and its pilots and retired pilots. That's not correct. Now, the language that I was pointing out to you is contained in on the 39 Record on Appeal at the PDF version, the computer version, at page 811, and it says, in pertinent part, that this is under the section dealing with the benefits to the retired pilots, and it's dealing with what the company will continue to provide them with. All this medical, dental, vision coverage, and so forth. And then it says, and such pilot spouse until age 65 at which time the company shall provide coverage which, when coordinated with Medicare benefits, shall maintain the benefits to which the pilot would have been entitled had he or she not retired. Okay? Now, we're not talking in this case about coverage. I want to make that perfectly clear. This is about what the cost, the premium, that Gene Wong has to pay for Medicare Part B. It's not the coverage. It has never been about coverage. Never. And that is clear in this record. And in fact, the Intermediate Court of Appeals decision on the earlier pages said something that was, it said it was something about redundant coverage. This is not a case about coverage. It's about what it cost Gene Wong over and above. It's a penalty case. He has to pay a penalty because
in fact, Hawaiian did continue the coverage it was obligated to do under that policy. Is that correct? Did Hawaiian actually continue the coverage it was required to provide under that collective bargaining agreement?
Absolutely. He's got, I think it's through HMSA, and HMSA is an insurance policy, is not an insurance company. It's a mutual benefit society. But anyway, that's another matter.
Well, if I understand the airline's position, it's that in order to resolve this claim, whether the negligence or the negligent misrepresentation claim, the court or the trier of fact is going to have to refer to the collective bargaining agreement and the provision that you're talking about in order to understand what the duty is that Hawaiian Airlines owed to Mr. Wong. What's your response to that argument?
That's a fallacious argument. The duty comes from this court, from the negligent misrepresentation in the State XRL Bronster versus United States Steel case. It doesn't come from any contract. This is not a suit on a contract. It has nothing to do with that. She undertook in this one-page letter that started this whole case. One page started three file drawers of paper, by the way. In this letter, she admitted, she told him that she was wrong about the late enrollment penalty. That's this one page started this whole case.
Was that only to your client, or?
Yes. Now she, I think there is evidence in the record, but I'm not sure for where it is, or. But my recollection is that she told that to other people because she said we've done this in the past. We've got this penalty waived for late enrollment. What happens in the Medicare program is when you turn when. Person turns 65, you become eligible for it. And if you don't get in right when you're eligible, every year the premium goes up 10% more, and it goes up to 340%. Now, Gene Wong is already in his 70s, and his father lived to be 104, so we think he's got a lifelong term expectancy, and therefore, at this rate, $100 a month, and who knows what it's going to be in the future, but at least for right now, it's $1,200 a year more.
So is it your client's position that Hawaiian Airlines owes a duty to any former employee that it gives advice to with regard to benefits or Medicare? What exactly is the duty?
The duty is to answer the question that was presented, and if she didn't know what the question, know the information, she should have said, you go to get a hold of Medicare because I don't know the answer to that question. But no, she undertook to tell him that she knew, she'd done it in the past, and that she admitted on March 1, 2010, that she made a mistake. So she owed him a duty having undertaken it under the negligent misrepresentation of Section 552 of the Restatement Second of Torts. And this court.
What is her status? That from which the duty arises.
The status?
Hawaiian Airlines owes him a duty? And she's a representative of Hawaiian Airlines?
Yes.
But, I'm sorry, is it your contention that any former employee who asks a question of the airline, that the airline then has a duty to that employee, or is it more limited than that? Literally every employee, former employee, who asks a benefit-related question, that does the airline have a duty to that employee, or is there something special or unique about this situation, and if so, what?
First off, it's not a benefit. It's the cost.
We've read it, and I think we do understand the issue. I'm just trying to focus you in on what I understand to be the question here, which is the argument by the employer that, in fact, you have to go to the collective bargaining agreement. The collective bargaining agreement is the source of the duty, and I'm trying to ask you, you've told me that's not the case, and then I'm trying to understand from your perspective, what is the duty and what is its scope? Is it a duty owed literally to every former employee who comes forward with a question regarding Medicare?
Yes, that they have that duty once they got asked and they undertook to do that. It's kind of like driving a car. Once you undertake to drive a car, you have to follow the rules.
So the duty would be not to negligently misrepresent facts to a retiree or someone like similarly situated.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of that.
Well, the duty then is to refrain from negligently misrepresenting facts.
Yes.
And you base that on?
State versus Bromster. Yeah, 552 of the Restatement Second of Torts, in which this court said that the duty to supply information does not have to be given by the person that's in the business of giving information. It has to be used in a business context, and surely when Hawaiian Air spends $2 million a month on insurance premium, that surely is business. And so this was a business transaction, not a social event. Even Don Ito in her deposition admitted that.
Mr. Jeschel, if I could follow up on this question about the nature of the duty and what the duty arises from, and move, if I might, just to ERISA for a moment. There is an argument that is being made, I'm sure you're aware of, that ERISA preempts this particular cause of action because what's happening here is that the benefits that are at issue are benefits that would supplement ERISA, sort of a field preemption analysis that would suggest that ERISA has occupied the field of benefits administration, and therefore it would be an ERISA issue that would in this case take precedence and preclude the cause of action that you're seeking to assert. And there are ERISA cases in which the administration of medical benefits is the source of a state cause of action. In other words, a litigant, a citizen, brings an action because they feel that the company hasn't given them the benefits they're entitled to, medical benefits they're entitled to by virtue of being an employee. So I wanted to ask you in this case why that analysis wouldn't necessarily apply. In other words, why wouldn't this be, because it is sort of a medical benefit, why wouldn't this be an issue that's within this field that ERISA is meant to cover?
My answer to you, Justice Wilson, is that it's not ERISA because it has nothing, this case has nothing to do with benefits. It has to do with the cost. The premium is the penalty, is the double the premium, essentially, for him to go and buy the Medicare Part B coverage, which is for the doctors. When he goes to the doctor, it's not about coverage. He's got complete coverage. It's the cost. And therefore, ERISA, this is not, they're not administering the plan by the cost. He's the one that has to pay for it, for the Medicare. It's not like, I mean,
matters of cost are not subject to ERISA preemption. Matters related to the cost of funding a plan are not matters that are subject to ERISA preemption. Is that your argument?
No, at all.
That's not your argument, or that's, you don't believe that to be true? I'm sorry.
Could I have the question again?
Sure. I guess my question is, are you arguing that matters of cost or the funding of benefits are as a matter of law not subject to ERISA preemption, or only that they aren't in this case?
I think generally, Chief Justice, that it's not, because it deals with the benefit administration. That's a plan, an employee retirement plan, just like the state plan is administered by whoever it is, five wise people or so. I don't know who it is, but I'm just saying that this, they're not administering Medicare. The federal government does that. And it's not, we're not talking about administering, we're talking about paying for it. And so the focus is, it's the wrong thing to focus on.
Can I come back to something about the, again, yeah, and, you know, just coming back to this question of preemption and the role of the contract, I mean, in arguing that there's a duty in the and a violation of the duty, wouldn't that necessarily require reference to the fact that the collective bargaining agreement contained information about what the duties of the employer were?
No, Your Honor, not at all. Because I'll tell you several reasons. Number one is the rule that says that if there's a collective bargaining agreement, you have to, if you have to interpret it, then it comes under Railway Labor Act. But interpreting it does not mean simply looking at it. Interpreting it is what some of the justices sitting here today have defined interpreting it if there's an ambiguity. There's no ambiguity in this case, because the words, what it said earlier, it's coordinating benefits. Coordinating benefits, it's not, there's nothing ambiguous about it, and it doesn't even apply to this case because we're not talking benefits.
If Mr. Wong had come to them and just said, should I sign up for Medicare drug coverage? If he had just come to this person and said, say at the end of the conversation, he said, you know what? I'm trying to decide whether I should sign up for Medicare drug coverage. Should I do that or not? And she gave him some advice. Would that be actionable from your perspective?
Yes.
It would?
Yes.
Because she had taken it upon herself to give advice to someone who was a former employee of the company?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Because it's the same thing. She undertook to do it. And then she admitted she made a mistake. So this is really a very simple case. It's not as complicated as three file drawers full of papers makes it. This started, like I said, just one letter. She admitted, and the thing is that it's just about cost.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Where do you come up with $286,000 worth of damages? I'm sorry. Where do you come up with $286,000 of damages?
Okay. It was a projection based on his life expectancy of 104 years. So at that time, it was like, I'm going to round it off, like 30 years life expectancy times the increase in premium projected out in the future, because every year it seems like, does anything go down? I guess the gas price went down this year, but anyway, most things just keep going like this, don't they? And so we did it. His CPA did a projection as to what it was going to be and made a chart, and that's how it came out to the $286,000.
What if Mr. Wong referred a friend of his? You know, at the end of this conversation, he goes, you know what, Ms. Yee, she's pretty smart. She really knows this stuff. I got a friend who's trying to decide whether to take drug coverage or not, and he refers that friend to her, and she answers the question. Would that be actionable if she gave him bad advice? Friend who has nothing to do with Hawaiian Airlines, other than he knows Mr. Wong.
If it was in a business setting, yeah.
Just literally,
social, we're at a cocktail party, and somebody said, hey, you know, what happened about this? Can I do that? No, I don't.
At the end of the same conversation he had, he says, you know what, I got a friend who, you know, could use some advice. Would it be okay if I had my friend give you a ring? And she said, okay. That friend calls, asks for the advice. Would that be actionable or not, or is it the fact that is there an employee versus a non-employee that's a line for you?
He's not an employee. He's a retired pilot.
Not employee. So neither a retiree. Somebody who lives down the street from Mr. Wong.
Do you know why that would not apply in this case? Medicare told Gene Wong to contact the personnel people at Hawaiian, his former employer, and find out if the premium can be somehow reduced or the penalty reduced. And so that's why he contacted Don Ito. And he had her phone number. That's what they do when they retired. Hawaiian gave him the phone number for Don Ito, the personnel people. They said, inviting them to call for advice. So,
under the scenario that you were just asked about, doesn't the negligent misrepresentation, the way our court has articulated it, say that it only applies for the person for whose benefit the information is supplied, suffered the loss? So it has to be the person to whose benefit the information is supplied. Under the that's how we set forth the elements of the negligent misrepresentation. And the restatement of torts, section 552, has a similar limitation.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, the negligent misrepresentation tort is not, you seem to be arguing section 552, but it's not limited to a business context, is it?
I don't believe so. You know, I read that over the weekend,
however, the plaintiffs, there has to be justifiable reliance on the negligent misrepresentation. And so, in terms of the context of a friend, I think the issue might become whether there is justifiable reliance, you know, based on like a gratuitous piece of advice that might be given by someone.
Correct.
However, in terms of a former employee, there may be issues as to whether or not, there's at least issues as to whether or not a former employee should be able to rely on representations made by the retirement people within the of the company with whom he was employed.
If I understand you correctly.
In other words, if I called Hawaiian and asked for information about my retirement, it may not be justifiable reliance.
No way is that covered.
But that's not the issue that we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a former employee. And in terms of former employees, there are employees at Hawaiian that are not covered by a collective bargaining agreement, are there not? What if Mr. Wong wasn't even in a collective bargaining agreement? What if he was management, exempt management, and the exempt management retiree called? Would he or she have a similar cause of action?
Yes, because it's a business. See, that's I had it here. It says in business.
I think it says business, profession, employment.
I'm sorry, Justice.
No, I was just reading from Section 552. It says, one who in the course of his business, profession, or employment, or in any other transaction which he has a pecuniary interest. So it's, as Justice McKenna was trying to point out, or did point out, that it's more expansive than just the word business.
I think the answer is, I see my 7-minute yellow light is blinking. Well, I better.
Let me just ask, if I could, real quick, can you just comment briefly on the 480 claim and your client's position with regard to that?
That he's a consumer, and whether you call it goods or services, or he invested funds, he's going to buy an insurance policy to save his wallet so he doesn't have to pay out-of-pocket expenses for medical care. Because when you get Medicare Part B, that becomes the primary carrier, and the employer plan is secondary.
But is this Hawaiian's trade or business? That's what the ICA said, that I guess the provision of advice like this is not what Hawaiian does as a line of business.
And that's where Bronster comes in effect. Says it doesn't matter whether they're in the business of supply. That's their business.
But 482 only applies for consumers.
480 only.
How is your client a consumer as with respect to Hawaiian?
Correct.
How is your client a consumer with respect to Hawaiian?
Because he's in a status of a consumer. Because what? He's going to, He's asking for advice or information as to how that premium, that cost of buying the insurance in a consumer, a buy-sell, he's going to go buy insurance, how that premium can be reduced or saved so he doesn't have to spend so much money to buy the product.
But is he a consumer with respect to the airline? In other words, is this the airline's commercial activity is not insurance, is it? It's
no.
Flying airplane. It's being an airline.
Yeah. But yes, but they do supply their employees with health insurance to the tune of $2 million a month.
So that's what you would say the hook is? So that's why this is part of the trade or commerce that Hawaiian Airlines engages in?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Yes.
Very well. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Now we'll hear from Mr. Hare.
Chief Justice, members of the court, please the court. Let me too join in the expression of appreciation for the court taking this time. It's a significant investment of your resources. I particularly appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation because I'm the appellee, the lawyer, and clearly there is something I would guess. It's part of the ICA decision that is somewhat troublesome or that the court has questions about. If I may, whether there's an actionable tort in negligence or negligent misrepresentation really is an interesting set of a couple of questions, but it's not the question to be presented here. Even assuming that they're actionable, and we can discuss that, it doesn't matter for preemption analysis. For preemption analysis, one takes into account that there's a state claim. It may sound in different sorts of torts. Commonly, you have negligent infliction of mental distress or intentional. You have a variety of torts. It's not a question as to whether those torts are actionable if you can establish the elements. We're not there. We're not parsing through 552. We're not parsing through 323. Those exercises were done in certain instances in which the Supreme Court stepped in and said, that's the wrong analysis. In Lueck, which we discussed in our brief, in Lueck, it was the Wisconsin Supreme Court that said, look, in this state, we recognize the bad faith tort of not processing or handling insurance benefits. In Idaho, the death of the 91 miners in Rawson, the court said, we understand the restatement position, but that's not the question.
But in taking Rawson, what happened in Rawson was that the agreement, that a collective bargaining agreement in that case, it specifically determined the nature and scope of the duty of the union. In fact, it set out the collective bargaining agreement established the Joint Safety Committee.
Yes, sir.
And so they specifically set out what the union had to do in the collective bargaining, and the actual allegation by the respondents in that case was that the union was negligent in its role as an enforcer of an agreement, which was the collective bargaining agreement. I mean, that case is so entirely different. It actually puzzles me how you can rely on it because it involves a completely different factual scenario.
Your Honor, with respect, in that case, Idaho Supreme Court, focusing on the restatement of torts, 323, I believe, said, we understand that this committee is rooted in the collective bargaining agreement, and we understand that they are to conduct inspections. Nevertheless, when they did an inspection, whether it was by contract or gratuitously, they assumed the duty of due care, striking resonance with the argument in part of the plaintiff here. When we made representations with respect to the interface between Medicare Part B and the Hawaiian plan under the CBA, we had a duty, and I think, Your Honor, you raise 522 in that context, to do it with due care. Well, in both instances.
That is not what I suggested.
The duty.
I don't think that they're arguing that it either. They're not saying the duty arises out of the collective bargaining agreement. They're saying the duty is completely separate. They're saying the duty arises out of the restatement and our common law in this jurisdiction. They're not pointing to any specific provision, unlike the Rawson case, where they were specifically looking at provision in the agreement that set it up.
Your Honor, I respectfully read Rawson and the dissent in Rawson and the Idaho Supreme Court decision in Rawson to rest on the argument accepted by the dissent, accepted by the Idaho Supreme Court, that it wasn't the collective bargaining agreement which drove the duty to conduct an inspection using due care.
And the United States Supreme Court, what it said about the Idaho Supreme Court, in fact, they quoted it, and what they said, that the Idaho Supreme Court acknowledged that the provisions of that agreement determined, quote, the nature and scope of the union's duty. That's the whole United States Supreme Court quoting the Idaho Supreme Court and saying that the union's lawsuit was dependent upon the terms of the collective bargaining agreement, and that's exactly not the situation here.
Disagree, Your Honor. I think it is exactly the situation here. When we look to find where there's a duty to provide information with respect to Medicare Part D or the Hawaiian program.
What if this was a management employee? Are you saying there's no duty to a non-union management employee that had no collective bargaining agreement? What if this had been a management employee that was not the subject of a collective bargaining agreement?
Your Honor, that may or may not be a preempted situation.
How could that be a preempted?
It probably would not.
The RLA.
It probably would not be preempted because it's not a collective bargaining agreement. So then you would have to rely upon a duty created elsewhere.
So doesn't that suggest that there is a separate, independent state law duty aside from the collective bargaining agreement if the same scenario would trigger potential liability for a non-management employee, non-collective bargaining employee?
Your Honor, may or may not be the case, but the inquiry stops too soon, I think, for Supreme Court jurisprudence purposes, when you stop at the elements of the state tort. When you stop at the elements of the state tort, you're foreshortening the inquiry. You have to then ask, in this case, you know, where is this duty that's going to inform whether the conduct in this case, one, ought to be protected, two, elements of things like reasonable reliance, justifiable reliance, the foreseeability of harm and the type of harm, all of these questions that are tied up in evaluation of duty, in order to fully inform that, and indeed 552 mentions the relationship analysis, under those circumstances here, with respect, you really need to go in to the collective bargaining agreement. When you read the complaint.
Why do you need to get into the collective bargaining agreement if the duty is owed to a non-union employee?
Well, this sort of mixing with respect to apples.
Well, he just happens to be a former union employee, but same duty would be owed to a management employee.
The analysis of that duty, in large part, would still come down to this interface and the duty to provide information. I mean, this is an information case, right?
Right.
The contention is that incorrect, false information was given. For purposes of evaluating whether there was a duty to provide information in the first place, and if so, the type of information and the nature and scope and the significance of any breach, you're flat into Rawson and Lewick.
But you can't look in the collective bargaining agreement, as you could in those cases, and find in the collective bargaining agreement, there's nothing saying that the employer is required to advise. I would agree with you. If the CAB said something to the effect, look, as part of our responsibilities in the collective bargaining agreement, the employer is required to give advice regarding Medicare, and that advice should be given on a six-month basis, and that the person had, if it had those kind of requirements, then yes, we would be interpreting it. But we're not interpreting it. We don't have to. This case can be resolved without relying on interpreting the at least that's the argument being made, that without interpreting or applying the CAB. That's the argument.
I understand that's the argument, Your Honor, and I disagree with the argument both on the law and the facts. With respect to the law, I think that you had the exact, you had a very similar situation in Lewitt. In Rawson, I understand the court's point about the committee, but nevertheless, the principles announced in all of those cases, including Norris, is that if a matter is substantially dependent, I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I don't remember any test on substantially dependent. The reason I'm just, I don't, you know, I tried to read that case very closely, and it didn't seem to, you know, what it said, if it can be conclusively resolved without interpreting the CBA. And that's the argument that's being made, that you don't have to go to the collective bargaining agreement in this case in order to resolve whether or not the tort claim here is viable or good.
Your Honor, I think that, again, with respect, that in Lewick, it's stated that...
So I'm just curious, what would the remedies be under the collective bargaining agreement then? Would there be any remedies under the collective bargaining agreement for negligent misrepresentation under these circumstances?
I believe
Well, he's no longer a union member, so I'm just wondering what the remedies,
well,
if
the law
any,
is quite clear under the RLA, and you've cited, I just think that's a non-issue, really.
Please just educate me. What would the remedies be under the RLA, under the CBA here?
I think the first step is to grieve it. You state the condition of the problem, and then the grievance committee acts, and then you have arbitration. There's no reason to suspect that there's anything other than a remedy that would be commensurate with whatever the Arbitration Adjustment Board thought appropriate.
In your answering brief to the ITA, you folks, it looks like to me, the way I interpret it, you actually question whether or not the CBA creates any sort of duty whatsoever, even if this had gone to arbitration. In other words, you're contesting whether the CBA creates any sort of duty, period. So it appears that you're arguing that the person in the state court has to go to arbitration because it's preempted by the RLA, but then once they get there, you're saying there's no duty or claim in that form as well.
I think it was set up as an if.
It was set up as an
if duty,
a couple
but
times.
But I think that you have to look at whether under the contract is our position, whether there was a duty to provide information with respect to Medicare Part B. And if there were, then I think you have the remedies provided.
Is there? Where does the CBA say that there is a duty to provide information regarding Medicare? Where in the CBA does that duty arise?
Well, that's why we say if. But if it does arise, it arises because of the language here relating to coordination with Medicare benefits and maintaining the benefits to which the pilot would have been entitled had she or he not retired. It is, again, mostly in the brief has been dealt with. You have the hypothetical here being realized, I think, Judge McKenna, that you pointed out, and that is you have an employee, a retired employee, saying to Hawaiian, well, how do these two things interface, Medicare Part B and the Hawaiian plan? How do they interface? That's his word. And when you try to provide
Does Hawaiian require its employees to sign up for Medicare Part A?
Hawaiian doesn't require that. Medicare Part A is free, so it's almost invariably that someone would
okay.
pick it up. Medicare Part B is not free, so part of the assessment of whether one takes it or not in some part depends upon whether you think your medical expenses are going to exceed the premiums that you would pay in addition.
See, I'd like to ask about Norris, because in Norris, the employer also raised arguments, not unlike those you're raising today, that the collective bargaining agreement could provide answers to the question of whether there was a cause of action. The collective bargaining agreement was relevant to determine whether the plaintiff in that case was required to sign off on the work that was done or only on the inspection. Or on the instead on the inspection, and that would require reference to the collective bargaining agreement. And the Supreme Court rejected those arguments and said that those are really factual inquiries that would go, that would be relevant, I guess, to determining the issues in the claim, but really were not determinative of the claim itself. Why wouldn't, in essence, that be exactly the situation here, that while it would be relevant from a factual basis to understand what the collective bargaining agreement did or didn't say, the duty doesn't come from the agreement. Rather, it comes from a common law-derived duty of care that this court may or may not say is owed to a former employee in this context.
I think you should first start, Your Honor, with, is there a duty to provide information related to Medicare Part B and how it relates to the Hawaiian plan? Because then it makes sense if you provide false or incorrect information under 552, you may well have liability if all the other elements are met.
And I shouldn't interrupt you, but maybe it'll help when you, because even if there was a duty of care, even if there was, if there is a similar state law duty, a separate one, the Supreme Court has said that's fine too. And even if the facts are common, that's fine too. If there's an independent state law or independent state duty, then you can proceed on that.
If the independent state duty as in Norris is requiring only as in Norris matters such as, is there a discharge? You don't need to go to the contract for that. Does the employer have a retaliatory motive? You don't have to go to the contract for that.
Well, Justice McKenna asked you, what do you have to go to in the CBA in this case for purposes of the plaintiff making out his claim?
I think what the plaintiff has to do is go to the CBA provision that we've discussed.
Yeah, is Kawhine conceding that the plaintiff, that there is a duty under the CBA for which Mr. Wong could have arbitration? Are you conceding that there is a duty under the CBA not to provide inaccurate information? So there is no duty under the CBA.
Now, that's not to say that there's no duty. It's to say,
how can it be preempted if there's no duty under the CBA?
Whose responsibility is it under preemption doctrine to make the determination of whether there's a duty under language provided in a collective bargaining agreement?
So basically, Hawaiian is saying that it can provide misrepresentations with no consequence to its former employees. There's no duty under the CBA, but the state tort claims are preempted. Therefore, there's no liability for Hawaiian.
The question of whether there's a duty, as the teachings of this court make quite clear, are a composite of a variety of different policy and factual analyses. That policy analysis as to whether there's a duty can only be properly answered by going to what is the promise made by Hawaiian in this Section 4 of Section 24 of the Collective Bargaining Agreement.
My question is, why isn't that just like the so-called factual determination or factual inquiry that Norris said doesn't bring you into the scope of Railway Labor Act preemption?
Because in that, there was absolutely no reference to the collective bargaining agreement needed. Was there a discharge? Was there a retaliatory motive? You didn't need to look in the collective bargaining agreement. Here, I submit that you need to look into the collective bargaining agreement in order to see where the duty came from to provide information in the first place.
So basically, you're saying there's no duty to a management employee then, right? That's what you're saying. You have to look at the collective bargaining agreement find a duty. Therefore, there's no duty to management
You're positing a situation where there's no collective bargaining agreement. Where there's no collective bargaining agreement, there's no preemption issue. The preemption issue goes not to whether the underlying state claim is actionable, but whether it's preempted. And it's preempted if it is substantially dependent on its resolution for an interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement. And here I respectfully submit that one has to look at the collective bargaining agreement in order to see when there's an interaction between Medicare Part B and the Hawaiian plan, whether there's a duty to provide information in response to it, two, if there was a duty, what's the scope and the breadth of that duty, and what are the legal consequences following if there's a breach? And that is Lewick, and Lueck's progeny that says that is all preempted for purposes of the state-federal relationship.
What if we were to find that there is no duty under the CBA, however, that Hawaiian assumed a duty?
Your Honor, respectfully, if this court inquires into the meaning, interpretation of this clause, that would fall classically within the preempted field that only either the federal court in the Labor Management Relations Act context or the arbitrable regime under the RLA in the first instance gets to do.
But isn't that, I mean, coming back to Norris, you know, the employer in Norris cited a contract provision that provides that an aircraft mechanic may be required to sign work records in connection with the work he performs, and that employees are protected from discipline for refusing to perform work in violation of state or federal health and safety laws. The employer said, gosh, to know whether Mr. Norris should have signed off on this part or not, you've got to refer to those provisions. And the answer from the Supreme Court is those are, in essence, factual inquiries that don't go to or aren't determinative of all they're relevant to. They aren't the basis for the claim. And similarly here, why is it that the provision in the contract wouldn't be just, like I said, a factual, similar to the issues that in Norris, the Supreme Court said, you know, those are just factual issues, but they don't drive the claim in a way that requires preemption. I just want to get your response to that so I understand Hawaiian's position.
The way the court handled that, the Supreme Court handled that on the last page of the opinion, and in the next to the last paragraph, they say, as Chief Justice has indicated, nor are we persuaded by petitioner's contention that the state tort claims require determination whether the discharge, if any, was justified by respondent's failure to sign the maintenance record, as the CBA required him to do, although such a determination would be required with regard to the respondent's separate allegation of discharge in violation of the CBA. The district court dismissed that count as preempted by the RLA, and respondent does not challenge that dismissal. The state court claims, by contrast, require only factual, purely factual inquiry into any retaliatory motive of the employer. So, again, what the court, to me, was saying was, you know, we don't have to go there to look at the collective bargaining agreement, because the only requirement of the state tort is discharge and retaliatory. And we can find or not find, as the facts may be, retaliatory based upon the examination of the employer's mind.
May I read you something from, it's from Livadas versus Bradshaw.
Livadas. With the case, Your Honor.
Okay, and this is what it says in the case. Finally, we were clear that when the meaning of contract terms is not the subject of dispute, the bare fact that a collective bargaining agreement will be consulted during the course of state law litigation plainly does not require the claim to be extinguished. Citing Lingo, a collective bargaining agreement may, of course, contain information such as rate of pay that might be helpful in determining the damages to which a worker prevailing in a state law suit is entitled. In other words, you're allowed to look at it, you're allowed to consult with it, you're not allowed to interpret it. And in this case, what the allegation of the plaintiff is the plaintiff is saying, you don't have to interpret anything. I'm not saying that the duty comes out of this case. The only reference they're making is to that one sentence, and that's it. They're not. They're advocating no interpretation, no consulting. No interpreting, only consulting.
Your Honor, the important to me part of what the court just read is that first few words. I believe to the effect of when you don't have to go to the contract language. So the test in any given case is whether you've got to go to the language of the contract. And here, we're saying that the answer is yes, and I would suggest that in looking at the record here, it is equally clear that you need to take a look at the contract language, because invariably through the complaint and through the other filings here that we brought to the attention of the court, there's constant references to the interface between the Hawaiian plan and Medicare Part B. And as a result of that interchange, that's the context in which the information was given that's claimed to be incorrect. And as a result of that information, given only because there's a duty under the contract to coordinate the two so that the plans come out with the same benefits that the pilot would be entitled to retire active.
I'm really confused now. What was the communication that was made? I thought it wasn't. I thought it was just that he could later sign up without penalty. I thought that was the only alleged negligent misrepresentation.
Well, I think that
not with respect to the interface between B and what the plan that Hawaiian provides.
No, Your Honor, I think that
the allegation is again what?
Well, I think if we read this is the complaint, that paragraph beginning 1 and 4, but there's numerous paragraphs here. That's the record, docket 39, volume 1, volume 1, 22.
Mm-hmm.
In 2001, when plaintiff became 65 and eligible for Medicare Part B, the defendant, director of employee benefits and compensation, this is the individual who wrote the letter that was referred to, as defendant's agent acting within the scope of her authority, advised plaintiff that he did not need to take Medicare Part B because the defendant would provide him with his primary medical insurance for the defendant's existing and current active pilot's HMSA group insurance program, and if he wanted Medicare Part B, he could switch without penalty later. The penalty is a component, but there's a series of ifs there that you see repeated throughout. Again, the idea here, paragraph 16, when he asked for advice on the option to take Medicare Part B as his primary health care insurer or remain with the defendant's HMSA active pilot's plan coverage. It's advice being asked, Your Honor, as pled, for whether it's better for this particular person to take B or to remain primary with the HMSA Hawaiian plan.
But that's not what's being alleged. The allegation is not that that information was incorrect. It's just that that portion where she apparently or allegedly said that he could sign on to Part B without penalty, that's the part that was wrong.
That may be the part that was wrong, but it needs to be considered in the context of that weighing of the respective benefits under the two plans, which was the question. Is it better for me to stay with just the Hawaiian plan, or should I go with the Part B? And again, the duty to respond to that question comes from the collective bargaining agreement. There's no duty in our view other than what's in the collective bargaining agreement. Yes, sir.
Is there an obligation under the HMSA agreement to apply for Medicare Part B?
There's not under the pilot's program. In many types of programs, there's a requirement that when you reach 65, you actually affirmatively have to go on to B.
So could Mr. Wong have simply just stayed with the program and not applied to Medicare?
Well, he did. He did stay with the program, and he did apply both.
But could he have not applied and just stayed with the program and then forego the penalties that were involved?
He would, but he would not be able to enroll in Medicare Part B without addressing the penalty issue.
Well, why would he want to if everything was covered by
HMSA? And when you read, again, the complaint, I think, is very illuminating, and I think the declaration that was filed in opposition to the first motion for summary judgment is very illuminating. I mean, why was not so much a question of I've balanced them out and I see that my cost benefit of if I get, you know, more glasses, I get, you know, more inspections. That wasn't it. In fact, what you do when you read through this is one of the reasons given that he feared that Hawaiian would go out of business, or into bankruptcy rather, if in fact they continued with their current business plans. That was one of the reasons, which again, when we start to take a look at then the justification, you've got a contractual provision which we pointed out is that Hawaiian has agreed that it would not reject the plan if it went into bankruptcy. And so when you start look at trying this case, when you start looking at trying this case and seeing what the issues are, you're constantly going back to what was agreed to, What was the alleged breach? What's the consequence of that? And what are the defenses to that? And there's a very large question of why did he do what he did? Was it reasonable? If you've got a comparative negligence stance. So
well, we're not there, right? We're really not there. We're only on the issue of whether or not this is preempted. Right?
Well, we are.
Whether or not there's, we haven't reached the issue of whether the court, trial court never reached the issue of whether there's actual potential liability.
And it never had to reach the question
right.
of 552.
Correct.
It was only on the point that whether it was preempted and before you get to the actionable nature or non-actionable nature, whether there's a duty or not, you have to parse through, in our view,
and
the
court had
bargaining
that,
agreement.
The court had that motion for summary judgment pending before it, and if that perhaps had been decided first rather than, I understand it was filed, but the court didn't address it or didn't, maybe it denied it or whatever, and then rule on the preemption.
Sorry, didn't the court resolve, did the court resolve the first summary judgment motion? I thought it was denied.
The first summary judgment motion was denied without prejudice.
That's what I mean.
That was brought on the basis that the 480 claim was barred because there was no allegation properly of consumer status, which I see.
I believe Justice Wilson had a question, and we've been I'll allow you a little bit of time to wrap up, and I'll give Mr. Geschel that same opportunity.
I'm sorry to prolong your time, Mr. Hare, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to state your position regarding ERISA. Assuming that it was determined not necessary to explore the collective bargaining agreement in order to determine the duty that would arise for the underlying causes of action, and therefore the Railway Labor Act was not preempted, do you have a position regarding ERISA, and how do you interpret the record below as to whether or not the court made a determination as to the preemption under ERISA?
Yes, both. Your Honor, in paragraph 9 of the complaint, plaintiff pled defendant had a fiduciary, statutory, and common law duty to claim to provide a plaintiff reasonably accurate Medicare retirement information, but breached that duty. One of the first questions, therefore, is tell me about these duties. Where did they come from? Where did they stem from? And so part of the motion that we brought initially was designed to attack what seemed to be, from answers to interrogatories, an ERISA position, that the duty that was involved here stemmed from ERISA. So we brought a motion for summary judgment. ERISA was bandied about almost as quickly as it was today with this court. We then, after having that motion denied without prejudice, filed another motion several months later after discovery, in which part of the discussion that we had was ERISA doesn't preempt, and here's why. And we cited a number of cases. I thought it was fairly extensively discussed. Rand Ingersoll was one of the leading cases on preemption of these kinds of actions. The answering brief said this is not about ERISA. We started argument on the motion before Judge Sakamoto. I started with, you start with duty. You have to find a duty somewhere. It can be from one of these three sources, but it has to be somewhere. If it is a statutory or fiduciary duty based upon ERISA, here's why it doesn't work. The judge stopped and asked Mr. Geschel whether the plaintiff was alleging duty under ERISA. And plaintiff's counsel said no. At that point, the judge said that aspect of the motion is granted, which frankly I interpreted to mean the ERISA claim is not here, never was here apparently. And so when this order was settled, I believe that the judge properly and the ICA appropriately as well said that ERISA is not a basis for an assertion of duty here. Therefore, this is not before us. The order is quite clear on the second summary judgment motion that preemption under the RLA is the basis for the court's dismissal of the negligent and negligent misrepresentation claims. So, Your Honor, I respectfully submit that the discussion of ERISA at this point in time, is a distractor and not helpful. It may be at some point in time because I do believe that there has to be duty, and one has to find duty somewhere. I don't believe that it's in ERISA, however, in this particular case.
Can you just briefly talk about the 480 claim? What's your response to Mr. Geschel's argument?
Well, the 480 claim was, we attacked it initially on the basis that the plaintiff has alleged a personal investment, and that gave consumer standing. We said that, no, the allegations are employer-employee relationship, retired employee is the same. Case law is pretty persuasive on that. In some recent cases by this court, I don't know how recent, but Davis and the line, while they're UMOC cases, they point to legislative history dealing with the service thing that you guys have heard many times, I think. And the legislative history is that employer employee, that's not a, you're not a consumer for purposes of 480. So there's a lot of law on 480. We brought that on a consumer basis that you haven't properly alleged it. Judge Sakamoto said that it's a purchase of a sale or service, a good or service. It wasn't argued. It wasn't pled. It's not in the complaint. We disagreed with that. I continue to disagree with it. We think that under Sieri, the court lays out its reliance and I think the persuasive effect of a great many of the Massachusetts cases. In this particular situation, I think Manning versus Zuckerman is probably a very good illustration of that reasoning, that the relationship between employer and employee is not a business context or trade or business. We've cited several cases to that effect. I think that that's sound law. By importing 480 into the employer-employee or something that arose within that relationship in which the respective parties were wearing those hats, as opposed to some other hat that they might be wearing, such as doing business with the company, under that employer-employee relationship, it's not trade or commerce for purposes of 480.
Very well. Anything further for the court at this time?
Your Honor, I sincerely appreciate this opportunity to have the conversation. I respectfully submit that in analyzing this, the proper analysis is to go, was there ever a duty to provide information with respect to Medicare Part B or with respect to the Hawaiian plan? If so, where do you find that? The only place that I can find that is in the collective bargaining agreement in this instance. And as a result of it being in this instance, the terms and conditions of that relationship and the advice on that relationship and the information on that relationship has to be addressed by someone that has authority to discuss meaning and agreement, scope, duty, consequences of breach. We're squarely in line with the teachings from Lueck down, from Andrews down, squarely.
I think you're repeating arguments that you made. So thank you very much at this point. We'll move on. Thank you very much. Mr. Geschel.
Excuse me. I don't believe I have anything else to add unless you have some more questions of me. I think we've pretty well worked this case over. Thank you so much, Brian.
Are there any further questions from the court? There being none, the court will take this matter under advisement. Thank you to both of our attorneys today for your arguments.